snake was the most cunning of all the animals that Yahweh made. He said to the woman,
did God really say that you should not eat from any tree in the garden?
And the woman said,
we may eat the fruit off of the garden and the trees, but not the fruit off in the middle of the tree in the garden. God says, don't eat it from the tree. Don't even touch it, or you will die.
The snake said to the woman,
die? You won't die. God knows that on the day you eat from it, you will see clearly, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil.
The woman saw that the tree was enticing to the eye, and now saw that the fruit was good to eat, that it was desirable for the knowledge it could give. So she took some of its fruit and ate it, and she also gave some to the man who was beside her, and he ate it. Then the eyes of both of them were opened, and they realized that they were naked. So they sewed fig leaves together and made garments for themselves. During the day's cool evening breeze, they heard the sound of Yahweh walking in the garden. And the man and the woman hid themselves from Yahweh in the middle of the garden's trees. Yahweh called to the man and said to him,
where are you?
The man replied,
I heard your sound in the garden. I was afraid because I was naked. And I hid myself.
Yahweh said,
who told you that you were naked? Did you eat from the tree which I commanded you not to eat?
The man said,
it was the woman that they put beside me. She gave me some fruit. Here, would you like to try it, Adam?
Yeah.
I ate it.
Yahweh said to the woman,
what have you done?
And the woman said,
the snake tricked me, so I ate it.
I don't think I can beat that. Hear now these words from Psalm 32, from the Common English Bible. The one whose wrongdoing is forgiven, whose sin is covered over, is truly happy. The one the Lord doesn't consider guilty, in whose spirit there is no dishonesty, that one is truly happy. When I kept quiet, my bones wore out. I was groaning all day long, every day, every night, because your hand was heavy upon me. My energy was sapped, as if in a summer drought. So I admitted my sin to you. I no longer hid my guilt. I'll confess my sins to Yahweh, is what I said. Then you removed the guilt of my sin. The pain of wicked is severe. But faithful love surrounds the one who trusts Yahweh. This is the word of the Lord.
Isn't it so wonderful to get to see our online family too via these videos? Thank you for the extra effort that takes, Mariana. So this is our fourth week in our current series, based on a lectionary and commentary by theologian Brian McLaren. Each week we are building on the previous week as we kind of work our way through the some of the significant stories from the First Testament. And if you happen to have missed any of those, you can always see them and catch up on the Hazelwood Christian Church site on YouTube. And the direct link to that is always in the weekly email newsletter. So last week, we considered the logos, or logic, that runs throughout the universe, and how we can know God through both creation, holy wisdom, and the life of Jesus. Today, we just heard the passage from Genesis 3. Now, it's really important for us to realize that we do not have to believe that this is a literal story of actual historic people in order for us to see the truth in it. There is deep truth here, even if you use the story as a metaphor. We humans have consistently picked the wrong tree. Too often, we have turned our back on the Creator's way and chosen another way. The story in Genesis 3 says it was a snake, which seems to perhaps represent a subtle and dangerous desire to choose rivalry and violence over harmony and well-being. Just as an actual snake can slither through the grass unseen until it's too late, human greed and hunger for power and control are often hidden until they strike and wreak havoc. In Genesis chapter 3, the man and woman feel a change come over them after partaking of the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, which our children personified for us this morning. Perhaps they are now aware of the desire to judge. Then God approaches. Instead of seeing God as a friend to rush out and speak with, they now perceive God as a rival to be feared, or someone more powerful who will judge them. They attempt to hide from God. And when God asks what happened, they quickly turn the blame on others. She made me do it. The snake tricked me. But each of them made their own choice. And some things have not changed. We know what comes next. Life gets harder and filled with pain. There's sweat, labor, frustration, and through it all, fear. As they make their way east of Eden, outside of their beautiful intended garden. If you think of that garden as a metaphor for God's intention for us, they have exiled themselves from it. And then, as the stories of Genesis continue, their two sons repeat the pattern. We didn't read this part, but most of us know the story of the siblings. The older brother, Cain, we might even say he's more advanced by our standards today. Cain becomes an agriculturist, also known as a farmer. His life is wrapped up in farming, fencing, barns, and accumulating. The younger, Abel, is less advanced or primitive, we may be tempted to say. As a shepherd, he is a nomad, traveling to wherever his herds may find fresh grass to feed upon. The nomadic life is just not really conducive to accumulating or claiming ownership of any defined part of creation. Their different ways of life result in different forms of offering. They become rivals in their giving to show honor to God, which are called sacrifices. They're competing, each of them, for a higher degree of God's favor, as if it's a limited quantity. When it is perceived that God was not as pleased with Cain's offering, Cain envies his younger brother, and resentment grows. He sees Abel as an enemy and decides to play God. And sadly, in this story of two brothers, Abel becomes the first victim and Cain the first murderer. We are only into the very earliest chapters of the first book of the First Testament of our scripture. These stories show us how quickly we turn away from reflecting the image of the creative, generous, life-giving, compassionate God that created us. In the story of Adam and Eve, we quickly become graspers of power, hiders and blamers who try to cover up our shame. With the story of Cain and Abel, we become rivals, resenters, and destroyers. What do these ancient stories mean for us today? I think they point towards what is broken in our world. Something inside human beings when we don't stay connected to our Creator and we make choices that lead us further astray. They remind us that God created us with the ability to choose, and we often choose broken desires. This is where we came from. Humanity stopped imitating God's desire to create, bless, and give life. Instead, we've chosen too often to imitate the prideful, competitive, fearful, and harmful desires that have been passed from generation to generation. Too often we see the desire to acquire, especially what another person has, the desire to compete and control, the desire to consume and discard, the desire to oppress, harm, or even kill, especially if someone is an obstacle to our other desires. Think for a moment how much imitation of other humans still runs in our lives today. Someone hits or criticizes us, what do we immediately want to do? Hit them back, criticize them even stronger. Someone gets a new TV, new house, new car, new something, or gets to have a fabulous vacation, and what do? We buy a TV, a house, a car, or whatever, or we have to have that vacation too, or better yet, we get one even bigger and better. But what happens when one just can't go right out and replicate those things? What happens when one feels that they just cannot keep up with the Joneses, so to speak? Too often, humans are tempted to rationalize unethical behavior, maneuvering, cheating, stealing, and lying to get what we want. A big problem in our society today is wage theft, where employers who are already wealthy steal the wages earned by the people that are already making very low wages so that they can line their pockets even more. That's just one example that came to me off the top of my head. I don't even have it written down here. Now, there is nothing wrong with desires. There are plenty of healthy desires that God has given us. But we have to always be alert. We have to constantly ask ourselves, whose desires are we imitating? To be truly, fully alive is to imitate God's generous desires. To create, to bless, to help, to serve, to care, to protect, to rescue, to enjoy. To choose otherwise, to imitate the desires of others and thus become rivals, is to choose a path of either literal or metaphorical death. Now, it seems so simple in the abstract, but it can be, oh, so difficult in reality. It is so easy to get caught up in the rat race of trying to outdo each other, to snag that next promotion, to make ourselves feel more important, to try to have more control, to mow over other people in pursuit of accumulating enough to feel safe, and to simply want our own way. We are too often drawn to compete instead of create, to impress rather than bless, to defeat rather than protect. We too often give in to the temptation to dominate rather than to serve, and exploit rather than respect. The temptation to only look out for ourselves and our own desires instead of what is good for others and the common good. As a result, we end up turning our neighbors first into a rival and then into an enemy, until we, like Cain, finally make them a victim of our aggression. And sadly, the more our neighbor doesn't look like us, think like us, or act like us, the easier it is to give in to the temptation to turn them into the enemy. We personally live in this drama of desire every day. Think of all the advertisers who are trying to influence and manipulate our desires to convince us we need their products so that they will increase their prophets. Think of all the politicians who start out wanting to help make things better, to serve the greater good, but fall into imitating the very system they set out to reform. Think of all the potential rivals who are eager to engage us in competition, who are always prepared to assume the worst and to pit their desires against ours. Think of all the people we thought were our friends, and then we find they have been figuratively stabbing us in the back, twisting our efforts to help into offenses. Think of all the times we want our families or churches or workplaces to make choices that fulfill our own desires. Think of how fear often drives our desire to be safe to the point of being uncaring and combative about the well-being of others, such as immigrants, refugees, and minorities. Even in small things, it can be so hard to let others make decisions, to let go of the need to control every aspect of our personal work or church life. What's true of us as individuals can be true of us in groups also. Both personally and socially, we are caught in the drama of desire. I find it more than a little ironic that the labor movement, the very movement that helped us get tomorrow as a national holiday, and who also fought for workers' comp, workplace safety laws, minimum wage, child labor laws, and so much more, is often now vilified as always being the bad guys. And their strength has been severely weakened by those in power who felt that they just lose too much when others are treated fairly. And Labor Day, a day meant for those who work physically very hard to have a paid day to rest from their labors, has now been turned into a retail marketing tool. And those who work in retail usually have to work even harder than ever to provide to the rest of us what we want to enjoy the holiday. Ironic indeed. But that is just one of many similar dramas of conflicting desires being played out every day across this country. We certainly have seen that in recent months. And that's another reason Jesus is so important to us. Because he modeled a different way of life. He gave us a real life in the flesh example of God's self-giving. That first man and woman grasped to be godlike, but Jesus didn't. He humbly poured his life out into serving others, even though it led to suffering and death. Jesus both leads us and points us in the right direction, reorienting us to desire, imitating the very heart of our loving God. Like David, in the psalm that we heard read this morning, our hearts are heavy and we lose our strength when we give in to the temptation of our desires and go against God's desires. I cannot help but wonder if perhaps David wrote this psalm after confessing his big sin. And wow, was it ever a big one. You may remember that David had Uriah killed in order to cover up the shame of David's raping Bathsheba, a rapist and a murderer, yet David was able to find forgiveness and restoration by coming clean with God. Psalm 32 reminds us that when we follow God's leading and God's ways, imitating God's desires instead of acting out of selfish desires, we too are restored. And Jesus reminds us of that too. Jesus' constant invitation when he was on earth, as well as continues to be, follow me. We might also express this as imitate me. To fully choose life is to be mindful that we continually live within this drama of desire. We constantly face temptations and the conflict of competing desires. Death-dealing ways of other humans or the life-giving ways of God? Which will we choose?